I'm Artie Moscowain. Welcome back to Radio Times. Well, back in 2003, there were calls in Congress to rename French fries Freedom Fries and calls to boycott French wine because the French did not support the war in Iraq. That's a far cry from the welcome the Marquis de Lafayette received in the 1820s when he made a return visit to the U.S. after fighting for independence in the American Revolutionary War. Our guest is humorist and historian Sarah Vowell, author of Lafayette in the Somewhat United States. It's about how a teenage French aristocrat came to the colonies looking for adventure and a cause. Her book is also a reminder of what we owe the French for our independence, who provided soldiers and weapons to Washington's bedraggled troops. Sarah Vowell joins us here in our Philadelphia studio, and it's a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us
on
Radio
Marty.
Times. Well, let's go back to the 1820s.
I thought I would come to Philadelphia and tell you people about the American Revolution.
Yes,
listen up.
Right, something we know
should really be interested in this.
Absolutely know nothing about. What's interesting is that it seems, I mean, clearly you love the Marquis de Lafayette, but it seems that America largely loves Lafayette.
They certainly used to. I don't know. Like, nowadays he's more of a place instead of a person, you know? I mean, after he came back in the 1820s, and it was this 13-month-long love fest, partly because he was the last living general from the Continental Army. All the old founders were dead or dying, that trip inspired everyone everywhere because he visited all the states at the time, the naming craze that we're left with.
Because he went to all these various places. And it's interesting that you describe that because we're here in Philadelphia. The Pope was in the city not so long ago. There was a complete sort of shutdown of center city Philadelphia to allow so many people to come in to see the Pope. And yet it sounded like, at least in New York City, what, half of the city came out to see Lafayette?
Yeah, more than half. I mean, Philadelphia was a really big deal, too. I think they had, in Philadelphia, they had hired this French chef to make this meal, this multi-course meal that was so elaborate and it was so hot out that the chef actually died from the effort. But his visit to Philadelphia on that trip was very sweet and sentimental, and he goes to Independence Hall, or he calls it the Hall of Independence, and talks about the importance of what happened in that building.
I do want to have you read from the beginning of your book, but I have to say your book reminded me that Lafayette was a teenager. What, he was 18, 19 years old when he came to the colonies to fight against the British. I mean, you think of 19, I realize people didn't live as long back then, but nonetheless, really a teenager who came to find, I think, himself here in this country.
Yeah, I mean, he came for a few reasons. One of them was that the British had killed his father in the previous war, so he had a bit of a grudge. Another reason was he actually believed in the Enlightenment ideals about liberty and equality. But, I mean, he was only 19, but he came from a military family and grew up in that French military tradition and culture, and had been to writing school with future kings of France and was part of the King of France's household troops. So he actually had way more military experience than most of the grunts on the ground around here.
In fact, you also remind us that the colonists who fought against the British, I mean, the soldiers were hungry. Many of them sort of fought almost near naked. I mean, it's really kind of I realize the book is full of humor, but it's really pretty shocking to be reminded how truly desperately needy these soldiers were.
I know. It's very meaningful around here because of Valley Forge and that, you know, classic visual of Valley Forge of the bloody footprints in the snow, because the soldiers were marching there in the winter, and many don't have shoes. And, you know, I mean, Lafayette talks about that and how, you know, they had to amputate the limbs and then they had to set up their Camp Crummy, I call it. And you know, 2,000 of them die of malnutrition and disease and exposure. And it's kind of an embarrassment. Partly, I mean, it's because the Continental Congress couldn't get it together to supply them with food and supplies and shoes and other luxuries like water, you know. So it's kind of a humanitarian fiasco. And then, you know, spring comes,
right,
as it does, and
yes,
the ones who lived are retrained, and then it becomes the Valley Forge story of them becoming a professional army and trotting off to victory.
I feel like I've seen that movie, perhaps as a child. Well, Sarah Val, I'd love to have you read from the very,
sure,
beginning of your brand new book.
All right. How did the Marquis de Lafayette win over the stingiest, crankiest tax protesters in the history of the world? He trudged from France to Philadelphia, hung around the building where they signed the Declaration of Independence, and volunteered to work for free. The Continental Congress had its doubts about saddling General George Washington with a teenage French aristocrat, but Ben Franklin wrote from Paris that the kid might be of use, and what the hell, the price was right. So, on July 31, 1777, Congress passed a resolution appointing Lafayette a major general in the Army of the United States, recognizing his great zeal to the cause of liberty. That, and the penniless rebels in their as-yet-unsuccessful campaign to shake down the King of France, hoped to milk Lafayette's illustrious family and connections back home. The Founding Fathers, while sticklers about taxation without representation in general, were magnanimously open-minded about the French crown overtaxing French subjects to pay for the French Navy to cross the Atlantic to lend a hand. The insurgents, as the French referred to the Americans, wanted what all self-respecting, financially strapped terrorists want: to become state-sponsored terrorists. Without an alliance with the French government, the Patriot rebels could not have won the war, and President Thomas Jefferson could not have written an inaugural address warning against the evils of entangling alliances. The newly dubbed General Lafayette was only 19 years old. Considering Independence Hall was also where the founders calculated that a slave equals 3/5 of a person and cooked up an electoral college that lets Florida and Ohio pick our presidents, making an adolescent who barely spoke English a major general at the age I got hired to run the cash register at a Portland pizza joint was not the worst decision ever made there.
And that is Sarah Val reading from the very beginning of her new book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States. When you begin a book like this, and you've written a number of history books, is that where you begin? I mean, when you begin your writing, is it what you just read?
Oh, is the beginning where I begin?
Is the beginning your beginning?
No, no. I mean, I don't know if it's good to go into how the sausage is made, but there are several dozen beginnings, and I'm no.
Well, you do.
I mean, I sit on my. Want to know how I do it?
Sure.
I sit on my living room rug. I have a bunch of index cards. I have all the stories, ideas, chronological facts, jokes, asides, various tangents. I have all of that. Each one gets its own card, and I sit on my rug for a few weeks, moving the cards around.
Very analog.
Isn't it? I mean, it sort of looks like the floor version, like on a cop show when someone comes in to the serial killer's apartment and they see the wall with all the photos and strings and, like, cards. And, you know, it's kind of like that.
Well, you visited a number of historic sites, Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly were just outside of Philadelphia, Brandywine Battlefield as well. I mean, that is certainly part of your research.
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, Pennsylvania figures in a lot to the Lafayette story because, I mean, he was wounded here. It's here he comes when he first, you know, arrives in America trying to get a job. Valley Forge, he was there for part of that winter. So, yeah, Pennsylvania is kind of central to his time in the war.
You quote Jefferson about Lafayette's, quote, foible as a canine appetite for popularity. It also seemed like he had daddy issues. The way you write about it, he saw George Washington as a kind of surrogate father.
Yeah, I mean, canine. He does have a puppy dog quality. It's part of his charm, but it probably does get on the nerves a bit, too. I mean, he was an orphan. He was an orphan by the time he was 11, so he did kind of have that orphan's. And he was also an only child, you know, which adds to the petulance, I think. No, I don't know if you're an only child, but...
No, I have one, but that's okay. No, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Well, you know what they're like. So, yeah, he did have this kind of yearning to be well-liked, but it had practical effects. Like, you know, he wanted Washington to like him, so he worked really hard, and he always pitched in. He was very gung-ho. Meanwhile, a lot of the Americans were just deserting in droves because they were like... I need food and money and shoes, and I'm not getting them here. But here was this kid who just wanted everyone to love him.
And apparently George Washington did.
He
among
did.
Others.
Yeah. I mean, Lafayette...
I mean, he seemed kind of lovable.
He was. I mean, he has a certain... I guess he always used French words. He had a joie de vivre and a je ne sais quoi.
Oh, altogether.
Yeah. But, I mean, I wouldn't have been interested in him if he was just... a flirty swashbuckler. I mean, he really did work hard. And even after the war, you know, a lot of the ways he helped the new American nation were really boring grown-up things like helping Nantucket whalers get the contract to light the street lamps of Paris. You know, he wasn't just this kid wanting a bunch of attention. I mean, he, like... That's love, you know.
That's love and a lot of hard work. He did, though, leave behind a wife. He left behind a child, a pregnant wife.
Yeah, they already had a child. I mean, they were so young when they got married, and she was a teenager, too, and he left her behind. She was pregnant, and yeah, I don't let him off the hook for that.
No. Do we know how she felt about that? We know what he said to her.
Could have been happier, you know. She was really sad. I mean, she loved him, but she was kind of the perfect wife for him because she believed in him and was, you know, constantly taking care of him and being on his side.
He says, "I'm too guilty to vindicate myself. Do not be angry with me. Believe that I'm sorely distressed." He asked her to embrace our Henriette. That was their daughter, their young daughter. And adding that her pregnancy, as you write, adds to my torment if you knew how painful this is. But it was his choice, right?
Uh-huh, yeah. If you knew how painful it is to for me to leave you to a pregnant woman. I mean, yeah. I mean, I think I say somewhere in the book about some other guy who was leaving his wife and child also to go from America to France that... History is probably full of great fathers, but recorded history is not necessarily where to find them, you know? I focus a little bit on the women every now and then and what they're going through when the menfolk are off at war, you know? I mean, one of the things I was thinking about...
Hold that thought.
Oh.
That's Sarah Vowell, our guest on Radio Times, and that's our theme music, which means we're taking a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about her brand new book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. We're getting a history lesson from author and humorist and historian Sarah Vowell. She's written a number of books. Her most recent one, just hot off the presses, Lafayette and the Somewhat United States. And to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We were talking about some of the women folk that the men left behind, I guess.
I mean, the war, you know, the first shots of the war fired in 1775. But the rebellion goes back 10 years before that when to the Stamp Act. And there were, you know, 10 years of resistance. And the women were really at the forefront of resisting Parliament's taxes upon them, and especially through boycotts and boycotting luxury goods from Britain, especially fabrics. It's sort of the advent of the homespun movement. I was always also thinking about, like, you know, the Boston Tea Party and how, you know, that's still inspirational right. to civic-minded hotheads today. But really, you know, the way a lot of colonial women in hordes dealt with that was they just swore off tea. And I was, and then they would do things like, let's boil basil in water to make us feel better. But really, I was thinking about that. And like, what is more valiant, like throwing crates off a dock or years and years of taking care of children from dawn until dark without caffeine, you know?
Television.
Oh, God. The caffeine thing.
You're a caffeine person?
We are.
You quote several times Lafayette says this, and it's interesting. He says, I do not hesitate to be disagreeable to preserve my independence. And this is his, I guess he said it, what, to his family, which is.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those only child statements, you know. But, I mean, he says it because his wife's father, who is one of the fanciest men in France, has gotten Lafayette this really boring job at the French court with the king's brother. And Lafayette is a soldier, and he wants to be a soldier like his father before him. And, you know, his ancestors were soldiers going back to the Crusades and Joan of Arc. And so to get out of this boring bureaucrat job, Lafayette just is rude to the king's brother, who does not want to hire him anymore. And that's what he says. I did not hesitate to be disagreeable to preserve my independence. Mm-hmm. But it sort of meant more to me in the context of this book, because so much of the book is about the disagreeability amongst the founders and just the disagreeability inherent in a democratic culture. Because, I mean, the thing about freedom is people express themselves and do not concur. So it kind of like that statement sort of took on larger meaning to me.
Well, let me quote you to you and to our listeners. This is about visiting Brandywine Valley to trace a soldier's steps. I don't think I see American history as war. I see it as a history of argument, a daily docket of estrangement and tiffs, big and grand like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, big and stupid like the impeachment of President Clinton, or small and civil like what's happening at this moment with these strangers in these pews. This is you talking about being
talking,
some Quakers.
These strangers were Quakers. Yeah, I'm sure around here you've had.
We know about Quakers around here. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But the idea that this is that we're one big long-standing argument. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that's what's happening today.
Oh, completely. I mean, when Lafayette gets here, he's kind of surprised by how much discord there is amongst the American side. And, you know, there's a whole conspiracy to fire George Washington. And Lafayette writes Washington from across the camp at Valley Forge, basically saying, I feel, and this is only after he'd been here for 5 months, I feel like the Americans can defend themselves, like they can successfully fight the British if they would just stop fighting with each other, you know. And Washington replies about the fatal tendency of disunion. And I mean, that certainly comes from the beginning, you know, down the road at Independence Hall. I talk about like the first thing that happened in the Continental Congress. One guy said, let's start with a prayer. The second thing that happened is two Episcopalians stand up and say, no way, we have too many religions, we can't pray together. And maybe they should have just called it quits right then and saved us all a lot of heartache, you know. But I ultimately came to believe that that is not our failing. I mean, this argumentative strain of our culture, which is so part of our DNA and comes from this town and the people who gathered here and established a government based on the separation of powers. I mean, that inspires
that's
a lot
failing,
of separation. No, it's not a failing. I think it's our strength. I mean, sure, it makes things inefficient and constantly annoying. And especially for me working on this project, because I was trying to research during the government shutdown of 2013 and Independence Hall was closed. But basically, I mean, the book ends with talking about places named after Lafayette, and I'm making the claim that to me the most meaningful one is Lafayette Square across from the White House, where people protest.
Absolutely.
And the disagreeability of preserving independence that goes on there, and how not only do we get to protest there, you know, if some foreign dignitary is in town from some less than democratic place, his citizens will come to Lafayette Park and protest him in America, because if they did that back home, they would be thrown in jail. And I see that as like something we can all be really proud of, and this constant, like, you know, yelling and argument and debate, while it does have its disadvantages, it is the privilege and the right of a free people. Wow, I'm getting all pontificating. I think this town brings it out in me.
Well, time for me to reintroduce you. That's Sarah Vowell, our guest in this this hour of Radio Times, this portion of Radio Times. And again, she's got a new book called Lafayette and the Somewhat United States. She has written a number of books about history, about American historical figures. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, let me read an email from Rob. He says, in our house, we love Lafayette, who we affectionately think of as a 1700s rapper, who we like to call Marquis D. Lafatty. I can't wait to read the book. So there's someone that is, I'm just reading here, is a 1700s rapper who we like to call Marquis D. Lafatty.
All right.
Is that...
I'll take it.
...suits your understanding of the Marquis de Lafayette?
I don't know, not necessarily, but I do like thinking... I like people who make the dead part of their lives. Because I certainly do it for a living, you know.
And is that just because you've always been a kind of history buff?
Sort of. I mean, especially like since I grew up in Montana, but then when I was 23, I moved away and I lived in D.C. and Chicago and San Francisco and mostly New York. And I made friends with a lot of statues, you know. I mean, I would take a walk. That's how I exercise, taking a walk. And you know, in fact, this book sort of comes out of that, because I lived near Union Square in New York City for 10 years, and there's a statue of Lafayette. So I would walk by him just about every day, you know, with my groceries or whatever. And, you know, he was one of my neighbors.
So is that what got you thinking about a book about Lafayette?
That was one of the things.
You also write in here, I mean, I use that in my introduction, and thinking about Lafayette and the French, I mean, certainly right before the Iraq War, the French were persona non grata for some people in this country.
I know. Well, in retrospect, a lot of Americans were maybe rethinking that one, too. So I think we could maybe forgive them.
Well, and even a reminder of what happened in Yorktown, as you say, without the punctuation of French gunpowder, it could have been a different result in that battle.
For sure. I mean, there was a secret kind of the French were helping the Americans secretly for a couple of years, but then in, I think, 1778, they signed the official, thanks to your boy Ben Franklin, they signed the official Treaty of Alliance, and that's when France sends over gunpowder and guns and cannons and the Navy and the Army and Rochambeau, and you know, they, at Yorktown, which is basically the conclusive battle of the Revolution, there are more French sailors and soldiers at Yorktown than Americans, and it's the French Navy blockading the British General Cornwallis, who's, like, hemming him in at Yorktown. That's why he surrenders, and that's basically the end of things.
Well, I love the way you describe the French soldiers. You say, as if stepping out of a Tchaikovsky ballet directed by Wes Anderson, the French soldiers wore plumed black hats and white on white, brightening their snowy leggings and jackets with pops of color on the lapels. They're sometimes pink lapels. Obviously, in contrast to the...
They're still French, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
In contrast to the nearly naked American soldiers.
I know. It was a kind of, I mean, one of the, you know, one of the French soldiers, or one of the French officers in his journal, he writes about George Washington hosting them in his tent for dinner. And the French officer is appalled because Washington serves them the dinner all on one plate. And there's kind of this vibe like, are these people animals? You know, one plate, no courses. But then, you know, once these French soldiers who are so well-fed and well-trained, they see what these, you know, ragtag bumpkins can do on the battlefield, they do win their grudging respect.
Let me get some callers. And we've got, looks like Rick from Warminster joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Fascinating discussion. I appreciate
Thanks.
It very much.
Sure.
My daughter wrote a book, Signing Their Rights Away and Signing Their Lives Away. And it kind of gives another opinion to the history. So I always enjoy those themes where we get things we don't get in the 10th or 11th grade history books. But her name is Denise Kiernan, and she wrote in an historic way, much the way you did. My question is did you mention in there his visit to North Carolina? Because Fayetteville thinks very much of Lafayette, and that is where Fort Bragg is. So a lot of his spirit is right imbued there in Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Sarah Vowell.
Oh, I mean, there are so many Fayettevilles and Fayettes and Lafayettes and, you know, I did not go to that. Have I been to Fayetteville, North Carolina? I don't think I have, but there are so many to choose from. I mean, probably the most notorious Fayette place is in Texas, which is where the chicken ranch was.
Oh.
You know, the best little whorehouse in Texas.
Right, right.
Or like Fayette. There's a Fayette in Wisconsin and also three towns in Wisconsin named Lafayette. So I don't know how that works.
Let me a comment from Elise says, does she talk about Ben Franklin and Lafayette? Did they have a relationship with each other? And indeed you do, Sarah Bell.
I do. I mean, most of the war, Franklin is in France and Lafayette is in America. So they do have interactions and they're both, you know, working toward the same end, which is the French alliance. I mean, one of the things we were talking earlier about the homespun movement and Franklin really like milked that these French, especially because of the Enlightenment and French philosophers like Rousseau, who had these notions of Americans as natural man. And Franklin, you know, in France really played that up, even though he was, you know, probably the most sophisticated American. He would only go out in public in his frontiersman's fur cap because he was personifying the rustic soul of America. And I mean, he and Lafayette, had, you know, these similar goals of not just encouraging an alliance, but sort of like fluffing it up a bit and encouraging like real love and affection between the two peoples.
We have an email from Warren, a serious question. Were the French supporting the Americans as a proxy war against the British?
Oh, for sure. I mean, especially in the beginning when it was all just secret, because for one thing, the French were still broke from being beaten by the British in the Seven Years' War, or what we call the French and Indian War. So they're secretly sending some gunpowder and supplies and stuff through the playwright Beaumarchais to... I can't remember how the French foreign minister puts it, you know, basically to... like keep up their morale to keep the Americans harassing Great Britain. But it takes them a while to decide, like, do we want to enter this war officially? Because when they do sign the Treaty of Alliance, Britain declares war on France. And, you know, France spends so much money on our war. They were already pretty well bankrupt. And this pretty much, you know, destroys them and leads to the financial crisis that sparks the revolution and gets our ally, his most Christian majesty, King Louis XVI, he loses his head over it, you know.
Well, it's interesting that we have today such a fondness, as a country, for the British, less so for the French.
I mean, that was sort of true during the Revolution, too. The French-American alliance had its rough spots. And, you know, the first thing that happened before that second wave of Rochambeau and Yorktown, they sent over this little fleet, and the fleet got destroyed in a storm, and the French fleet abandoned these American army and militias in Rhode Island, and everyone in New England just erupted with anger at the French. And, you know, a lot of the Americans talk about our ancient prejudices, which go back because they had only I mean, they had only been American for like 3 years, and they had been British for hundreds of years. And these animosities between the British and the French go back to, you know, at least the Norman invasion in 1066. So, I mean, one guy in Boston, there was a riot against the French, and a French officer who stepped in to, like, try to quell the Nerves was killed. And, you know, because it's Boston in the 18th century, and this Frenchman was a Catholic, and so was his corpse. There was a big to-do over whether he could be buried with the Catholic ceremony. And they, basically the Boston Fathers, felt bad about killing their ally. And so they had a secret funeral in King's Chapel in the middle of the night to give this guy a proper burial. So there were some, yeah, there were some rough spots in that alliance.
You were not a history major. You were an art major, right?
I have a master's degree in modern art history, yeah.
And because you're interested in, I mean,
did stumble into the writing about history. I mean, I did a lot of different kinds of writing the first decade or so of my, I guess the word is, career. And then when I was working on This American Life in the 90s, I made a documentary about the Trail of Tears, following the path of that, because some of my ancestors are Cherokee. And that changed my life, because I loved it. I think I'm maybe better with the dead than the living. I also really like going to historic sites as part of the research and part of the story and learning from people on the ground, you know.
Well, we are out of time, but I really liked your description of going to Colonial Williamsburg and meeting the reenactor who plays Lafayette, but also just sort of seeing the reenactment of life in Williamsburg.
Oh, I was pleasantly surprised by Williamsburg. I thought it was going to be really corny and kind of like looking on the bright side too much. But there, you know, we got there, we're like suddenly in an angry mob. I mean, it really captures how miffed everyone is during the Revolution, because, you know, nice guys don't revolt.
Sarah Val, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And her book is called Lafayette and the Somewhat United States. She's speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Free Library of Philadelphia. We have another guest waiting in the wings talking about money and politics after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. There are 120 million households in the United States, and according to a recent article in the New York Times, 158 of them are responsible for almost half of the money that's flowed in support of the Republican and Democratic candidates for president so far. How much money are we talking about? $176 million as of filings earlier this year. Joining us is one of the authors of the story, Nicholas Confessori, political reporter for the New York Times, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I hear you're in a cab in New York. Is that true?
Yes, I apologize for that. I had a doctor's appointment that ran late. I'm calling you from a cab, and for some reason, somebody is sawing wood next to my cab. I will keep moving.
All right. Just keep driving around the city, and we'll keep talking.
All right.
Looking at your article, is this because of Citizens United that we're seeing so much money up front flowing into these into the political stream?
Absolutely. This concentration of political wealth is not possible before Citizens United, which allowed the creation of super PACs that could collect contributions that were unlimited from the wealthy and from businesses and labor unions. That's what gives us the concentration of so much money from so few people in the campaign so far.
And in fact, this $176 million, that's really as of, what, June? So there's probably more money sloshing around since then.
Yes. I mean, what we've seen is that the candidates themselves, for the most part, on the Republican side, are having trouble raising money. The Democratic candidates, for the most part, are the ones who are raising a lot more money. In fact, I think if you combine candidate money to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, you've got as much or more than all the Republicans combined for the summer quarter. So really, it's possibly even more of a concentration, although I suspect as the campaign matures and we get down to just two candidates, one from each party, we'll see less concentration. But what matters, Marty, is the upfront money, the venture capital money, if you will, in the campaign is coming from a few well-connected families.
Well, in fact, and you take some of this apart, you also name names, but it looks like people that have made money in hedge funds or in finance and people that are making money in oil, natural gas, I guess energy, those are the two economic sectors?
Yeah, I would say the bulk of the families on our list are from those two sectors, but I would clarify, what really intrigued me about our data was that we're not talking about ExxonMobil and Goldman Sachs here. We're talking about self-made entrepreneurs for the most part who left larger established companies, who left kind of mainstream corporate America and struck out on their own. They started private equity firms or hedge funds or are in asset management or venture capital. On the energy side, they're wildcatters. They're the people who saw the fracking boom coming early and got in early when the big oil companies were afraid to get involved and thought it was uneconomical. So it's risk takers. It's people who kind of challenge the conventional wisdom.
And what are the zip codes? Where do these people live?
Well, for the most part, they live clustered around fewer than 10 cities around the country. I couldn't tell you the exact zip codes, but it's the Upper East Side. It's Bal Harbour. It's a private island in Miami. It's Beverly Hills. It's Bel Air. It's Preston Hollow. It's in Texas. It's a few exclusive neighborhoods where most of these folks live.
And as you say, most of the money has gone to Republican candidates, so I'm assuming these are conservatives. What do they want for their money?
Well, it's a good question, right? Because people of great wealth, are pretty discreet about their political views. In fact, there was a fascinating study by Benjamin Page, a scholar at Northwestern, that came out recently called Stealth Politics, which was entirely about the difficulty of assessing the political attitudes of wealthy donors. But we can look at the candidates who they've given money to for the most part. And those candidates, for the most part, favor rolling back taxes, getting rid of the estate tax, which exists to prevent the accumulation of wealth over generations. They favor paring back regulations. They favor the Keystone pipeline. They favor ending the ban on the export of oil from the U.S. So you can sort of see the alignment of public interest and self-interest and candidate interest in these contributions.
Well, as you write, really in contradiction to how the majority of Americans feel about those very specific issues.
Well, I think, actually the majority of Americans support Keystone. I think it's a narrow majority in favor of building Keystone. So on that issue, there's no variance.
Right.
But where there is kind of a break is that wealthy people, and we see this in studies generally of the 1% and the upper 1%, the 0.1%, people of great wealth tend to have a lot of worry about entitlements. They care a lot about the size of government and the potential for government spending to reach deeply into their own pocketbooks. And they are not against taxes per se, but they think that they pay enough taxes and are usually a bit overtaxed. So their primary concern at that level is matters of how you pay for the government and who pays for it. And on those issues, they really are at variance with the majority and, in some cases, the vast majority of public opinion. If you look at Pew Center polls and many other surveys, you see a lot of support for preserving Social Security benefits, for preserving health care benefits for older people and for poor people. You see a lot of support for entitlement programs. You see a lot of support for raising taxes on the very wealthy. And for the most part, these are all ideas that the very wealthy oppose.
And who are the top recipients? We're talking about 158 families and corporations here, the money largely flowing to Republican candidates. Do we know who's the top beneficiary?
The biggest single beneficiary is Jeb Bush. His super PAC collected $100 million through June 30th of this year. They probably have even more now. But what's interesting to me is that the single largest contributions were going to other candidates, chiefly Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas. And this goes back to that point I was making earlier. Ted Cruz is not a candidate who is beloved by his party's donor establishment. He's not the favor of the 500 or so people around the country who raise money for candidates, who bundle campaign contributions for candidates, right? But he's getting $38 million from three or four families around the country who believe very strongly in him, who put a lot of money behind him, and those are the single biggest contributions on our list.
Well, picking up on that, is that a good business decision coming from these families? I mean, it's not clear, at least today, that Ted Cruz is going to be president of the United States. Seems like a risky bet on their part.
Well, you know, these are people who are risk takers and have a high appetite for risk. It's how they made their fortunes. It's not people who inherited money. It's people who went out and earned a lot and took risks, and the risk paid off in a huge way. And so there's some similarity to their role in the campaign right now. The biggest contributions are venture capital money, essentially, for candidates who are outside the usual pecking order, like Ted Cruz.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Nick Confessori, political reporter for The New York Times. We're talking about a story that he co-authored in the paper recently, looking at where a lot of money is being spent. 158 families and businesses responsible for a lot of money flowing in support of Republican-Democratic candidates, largely through super PACs. And we're talking about $176 million. That was as of the end of June, a filing date, so clearly a lot more money in the system. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I should add Nick Confessori driving around New York City in a cab talking to us on Radio Times. You also describe someone under the heading of mystery money, a man named Shen Shu-Ti, giving $500,000 to Right to Rise USA. That's a super PAC backing Jeb Bush. You mentioned all the money that he's been getting. Who's Shen Shu-Ti?
I have no idea. he is presumably, if he's not breaking the law, he is either an American citizen or has a green card, which would allow him to make campaign contributions in the U.S. The FEC for a form is the Federal Election Commission disclosure forms describe him as retired. But there is almost nothing in public records about him. So, frankly, if you have listeners who are in Hong Kong right now who have some idea who this guy is and how he made his money, have them call me because I would love to know. And besides him, as far as mystery money, we also have mystery money from corporations. Remember, corporations can give to super PACs, but they can't give to candidates. That has opened the door for what are functionally contributions from unknown parties, right? You can set up a corporation or an LLC, as they're called, and the corporation can make the contribution. And if that corporation is based in a state that doesn't require corporate documents to have the name of the people who have the majority ownership of that corporation, there is no way to know who is providing the money for that corporation. But you can be darn sure that the organization, the super PAC who's getting the corporation, will know.
Are we talking a mailbox?
For the most part, it could be a mailbox. There was one interesting contribution of $100,000 to Jeb Bush's super PAC that came from a company that shares an address and a suite number with a kind of, firm in New York, an investment firm in New York that is shared by Jeb Bush's cousin, George Herbert Walker IV, I believe his name is. Now, George Herbert Walker IV made a contribution under his own name, and many, many executives at this firm have also made contributions both to Jeb Bush's campaign and to his super PAC. But somebody at that firm, it appears, was intent on protecting their identity, and they used this LLC, which I believe is registered in Delaware, New York, one of the two, to make the contribution. We have no idea who provided that $100,000. And $100,000 is a lot of money in politics, even today.
Even today. Yes, even today. That's the appeal of the super PAC, is it not?
Yeah, it's two things. One, a super PAC can accept an unlimited contribution. Jeb Bush, the candidate, can only accept $2,600 from any one person. A super PAC could accept $1 billion if you can find a donor who wants to give it. But it can also it's also the corporate contributions. The corporate contributions allow essentially money laundering into campaigns. They allow the use of shell companies to make contributions, and that protects the identity of the donor.
You also and the cutoff was $250,000 or more. On that list is Hillary Rodham Clinton.
That's right. And Jeb Bush, I should say.
And Jeb Bush is, yes, exactly.
Look, what we have in this country, if you, if, if you cover Congress, if you cover the presidential campaign, what you quickly learn is that most people who run for office today are themselves rich. They raise money from wealthy people, and they are themselves wealthy. So Hillary Clinton is a wealthy person, so is Joe Bush, and they self-funded parts of their campaign early on to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Your average middle-class person wants to run for office cannot do that. And it is one more advantage that the system provides for people of wealth. In this case, of the self-funding has always been allowed. It's not new or unusual, but it just shows you. And that's why we have them on the list, because their campaign records show large contributions to themselves.
We should focus just a bit on the Democratic side. George Soros, a very familiar name, is a contributor to Democrats, to some liberal causes. Who else has been supporting Democratic candidates?
Well, there's a man named Aim Saban, who started or whose company owns the Power Rangers. He made a fortune in entertainment. In fact, a lot of the money in the Democratic super PAC comes either from Wall Street or from Hollywood. And on top of that, some labor unions have put in some money. We have Thomas Lee, who is credited with one of the kind of first real private equity firms. He's a real pioneer in that industry. His former wife, Barbara Lee, is also on the list. She donated some in-kind contributions, as we call them, of research and polling. And then Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's been a big, big figure in Democratic fundraising for many years. I think he was the biggest single fundraiser for Barack Obama's presidential campaign. And we see here now that he's also one of the seed donors for Priorities USA, which is the super PAC that is now supporting Hillary Clinton.
We have an email from John. He wants to know, are the Koch brothers on this list?
In fact, they are not. It's important to understand that the Kochs are really, for the most part, very opposed to campaign disclosure laws. Historically, they've opposed them. And their apparatus, if you will, their network, is built almost entirely out of nonprofit organizations that kind of maintain their tax independence by saying that they are not primarily involved in election politics. And furthermore, on top of that, I think because of the Kochs run this network of several hundred other donors, a contribution from them is seen, is widely viewed as some kind of a signal or a semi-endorsement on behalf of the network, which I think a lot of people in their network have different candidates they favor. So they have not put any money into these candidate super PACs, and I'm not sure they did in the last cycle either. They mostly contribute to their own organizations, which then intervene independently in these campaigns.
I'm thinking about Sheldon Adelson, who supported Newt Gingrich, 4 years ago. Obviously, that didn't work out so well. I mean, can we say that if it doesn't buy you the White House, what does it get you?
Here's the way I think about it. You know, there was a lot of debate in 2012. Oh, people of wealth lost the election. Mitt Romney had this big super PAC, and they lost. But I don't think about it that way. I think about kind of what is the daily life of the candidate, whoever he or she is. And I think that a system that requires candidates of both parties to spend a huge amount of time and mental energy courting and thinking about the needs of very wealthy people is itself a form of influence. If you are always thinking about who is the sugar daddy or mama that you have to get on your side to fund the super PAC that your friends are going to set up, that is a lot more influence than the average person is ever going to see in politics. So I think essentially it's a class power that is exerted on both parties and candidates of all parties now, and not so much a question of which side won any given election.
Well, Nicholas Confessori, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's my pleasure.
And a political reporter for The New York Times, and he was driving around a cab in New York talking to us on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.